And now on 4Extra, we continue the expedition of Humphrey Clinker. In the previous episode, the hypochondriac Matthew Bramble and his exhausting family experienced Scotland. But now they head home with their reliable footman, Humphrey Clinker. And each day proves big with incident and revelation.
To Dr. Lewis, Carlisle, September the 13th. Dear Lewis, we proceeded by the Solway Firth here to Carlisle. You must know that the Solway sands upon which travellers pass at low water are exceedingly dangerous, because as the tide approaches, they become quick in different places, and the flood rushes in so impetuously that the passengers are often overtaken by the sea and perish.
To Sir Watkin Phillips, Bart, Jesus College, Oxford. Carlisle, September the 13th. Dear Phillips, while crossing the Solway Firth, we suddenly perceived a drowned horse, which Humphrey Clinker, after due inspection, declared to be the very identical beast which Mr. Lismahago rode when he parted with us. This discovery, which seemed to intimate that the lieutenant had shared the fate of his horse, affected us all, most particularly Tabitha, who shed salt tears. But when we finally arrived at Carlisle...
You're asking what for that spavin' chestnut?
The lieutenant!
I'll have the green.
His ghost has kept his word to meet with us.
Well then, we had better join in the illusion. Lieutenant Lismahago, I'm very glad to see you.
Oh, and I, you, Sir Bramble. Miss Tabitha, I kiss your hand.
Your lips are so warm.
You must thank the good measure of whiskey they gave me at the inn. Without it, your hand would have received not a kiss, but a frostbite.
We feared you were drowned.
And so I should have been, after my horse dropped dead crossing the sands, had I not been rescued by a passing postchaise.
If only you'd met with us at Dumfries, Humphrey Clinker would have seen you safely across.
I did inquire for you, but having no news came on ahead. I'm urgent to get to London and then embark for North America, where I intend to spend the rest of my days with the son I had by my beloved Squinkin' Acoustic.
No!
What?
I forbid it!
Oh.
Speak to him, Matthew!
You will not be settling in Scotland?
Think of the dangers to which you would expose yourself through a long sea voyage. Then the journey across land, surrounded by savages. Think also how your abandoning Great Britain could prove fatal to the feelings of some deserving person whom you, and only you, are qualified to make happy for life.
Yes, thank you, Tabby.
Then my uncle, who truly is a Don Quixote in generosity, realizing the Lismahago's real reason for leaving was the impossibility of subsisting upon a subaltern's half pay, drew me aside.
Jerry, am I wrong in sensing something particular in the lieutenant's attention to Tabitha?
No. It goes some way to meeting her attentions to him.
So if I were to paint for you this small vision of the future... Tabby and the lieutenant settled comfortably in our neighbourhood. I and my servants, free of a very troublesome, not to say tyrannical, influence. While I myself enjoy brief interludes of Miss Mahargo's entertaining conversation, without being obliged to take more of his company than I desire.
It sounds idyllic.
I hadn't seen it in quite that rosy light.
Even better, it sounds practical.
I'd meant to tell you, Doctor, that as we travel through Drumlanrig in Scotland, the Duke of Queensbury did us all the honour to receive us at his castle, together with about 20 other guests. The longer I live, the more I am convinced that superstitions are never wholly eradicated from our race, even when rationality proves them absurd. I am led to this reflection by what passed at the Duke's table after supper. The conversation turned upon the vulgar notions of spirits and omens that persist in North Britain. And all the company agreed that nothing could be more ridiculous. However, one of the company then turned to me.
Well, there's no doubt that the warped imagination is very apt to produce visions, but I would need some other explanation to account for something that happened just 8 days ago in my neighbourhood.
What was that?
A young gentleman who could never be described as fanciful was standing by his gate in the twilight when he was visited by his grandfather, who had been dead for 50 years.
In the twilight? Well, what other explanation does one need?
The spectre was mounted on the very horse he used to ride.
But that's still no reason.
And then lifted a huge horsewhip and brought it down hard across the shoulders of the young man. I saw the marks with my own eyes. And afterwards, the sexton of the parish saw the same apparition hovering about the very tomb where the grandfather's body lies buried.
Nonetheless, I don't doubt that one day it will turn out to have been a trick played upon the young man by some enemy. Make of this what you will, Lewis, in the light of my conversation with Mr. Lismahago.
So, you really have given up all idea of settling in Scotland, Lieutenant?
A prophet is little honoured in his own country.
Mm, so it is said. I've never had proof that it was true.
What's more, my home is no longer my own.
No?
I came to the place where I was born to learn that my nephew had married the daughter of a weaving manufacturer. Mm. I reached the gate in the twilight to hear the sound of treadles in the great hall. As outrage swelled in my breast, my nephew chanced to come out of the house, and in a burst of indignation, I cried, "Degenerate rascal, you have made my father's house a den of thieves," and struck him with my horsewhip. Then I rode away to the village and stood by the graves of my ancestors. Having paid my respects, I bid my native country an eternal adieu and determined to seek peace among the forests of America.
So much for the apparition at Drumlanrig.
What was that?
Someone told me just such a story to persuade me to believe in ghosts.
Well, I would be glad if my resentment had had such a powerful effect.
But do you really need to travel so far as the Americas to find peace? It will soon be winter. Not a good time for a sea voyage. Why don't you postpone your journey and pass the stormy months with us at Brambleton Hall?
Manchester, 18th September, Mrs. Gwydym. As we are drawing homewards, it is time to remind you that Brambleton Hall must be in a condition to receive us. By the 1st of October, you may begin to make fires in my brother's room and in mine, and also in the yellow damask room, where the feather bed should be well aired, because, with the blessing of heaven, it may be used sometime soon. If the house were mine, I would turn over a new leaf. The servants of Wales should drink nothing but water and eat hot cakes and kale as they do in Scotland. Anyway, I hope you have managed to reform their behaviour and set their minds on higher things than caterwauling with country lads. I have to say that Wynn Jenkins has become a new creature under the influence of our footman, Humphrey Clinker, a very pious young man. And I pray every day that he will take the same pains to penetrate that hussy Mary Jones, and all of you, to instill his goodness into your most inward parts.
Buxton, September the 20th. Dear Lewis, my sister Tabby's advances to Lismahago continue apace. And if I may trust appearances, the lieutenant is willing to grasp opportunity by the forelock. But on other matters he has become more paradoxical than ever.
Your breath of Scottish air seems to have done you good. No doubt you are heartened to see the country rising out of its ingrained poverty.
Those who reproach a nation for its poverty when it is not the fault of its people deserve no answer.
I'm not sure that I...
Furthermore, if poverty be a subject for reproach, it follows that wealth is the object of esteem. Riches are no proof of merit, on the contrary. They tend to pervert the understanding and the morals.
But surely you must be cheered by the effects of the Union with its immediate improvements to agriculture, commerce, and good manners.
Scotland is rich in natural resources. Vast flocks of sheep, large forests of timber, and the earth is still more rich below the surface with inexhaustible stores of coal, stone, marble, lead, iron, copper and silver, with some gold. And yet you seem to ascribe the present prosperity of the Scots to the union with England.
But surely you would not deny that the quality of people's lives is better. There's more trade and more money circulating since the union.
This improvement is all part of natural progress. In recent times, the Dutch, the Swedes, and the French have greatly increased their prosperity. In fact, I would state that the Scots are losers by the Union. They lost their independence, they lost their parliament, and their courts of justice were subject to the supremacy of an English tribunal.
Oh, calm now, Lieutenant. You cannot be said to have lost your own parliament while you're represented in that of Great Britain.
True. The 16 peers and 45 commoners of Scotland must make a formidable figure against the whole English legislature.
While I was sitting in the Commons, the Scottish members always boosted the votes of the government.
I agree, sir. They do generally side with the majority. So much the worse for their constituents.
Well, I must say, you have argued stoutly for your country. And I shall be very glad when your peasants can afford to give all their oats to their cattle and indulge themselves with good wheaten loaves.
Will you indeed? Yeah. Did you know that a mouse, with its infallible instinct for self-preservation, will always prefer oats to wheat?
At least let me wish your peasants such a degree of prosperity that they may follow their own inclinations.
Heaven forbid! Woe to the nation where the multitude is at liberty to follow its own inclinations.
So much for the dogmas of my friend Lismahago. I must say I was a little nettled to find myself schooled in so many particulars, but I was not prepared to argue, as I believe that he is very likely to decide to settle in Monmouthshire. For after we had walked another mile in silence, he suddenly halted.
Sir, would you have any objection to the success of a gentleman and a soldier should he be so fortunate as to engage the affection of your sister? I mean, what is your view?
My view is that my sister is old enough to judge for herself.
September the 28th. Dear Watt, we have passed through Buxton, but as my uncle did not much relish the accommodations or the water, we stayed but 2 nights. Our adventures, however, begin to thicken as we advance southward. Lismahago has now pronounced himself the admirer of our aunt, so a wedding by Christmas seems certain. I was going to ask you to ride over for the occasion, to help me throw the stocking and perform other ceremonies peculiar to the occasion, but this delightful prospect may well vanish, due to a misunderstanding between the future brother-in-laws. A few days ago, my uncle and I, visiting a relation, met Lord Oxmington, who asked us to dine with him the following day. We had a fashionable meal, served up with much ostentation, but before the dessert was removed, our noble entertainer proposed 3 general toasts, then called for a glass of wine and bowed all round.
Gentlemen, I ask you to raise your glasses in honour of our esteemed monarch, King George III.
King George!
I wish you all good evening.
Oh. Yeah, Lord Oxmington. Are we being dismissed?
I shall be glad to see you another time, Mr. Bramble.
Oh, there is no time like the present. We have not yet finished our dessert, and your lordship has yet to drink the traditional toast of the best in Christendom.
I'll drink no more bumpers today, and I'm sorry that you obviously have already drunk too many.
What?
Order the gentleman's carriage at once.
A fellow, tell me how much I should pay for this meal.
Sir, this is no inn.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Of course, if it were an inn, the landlord would be more civil. There's a guinea.
Sir.
Take it and tell your lord that I shall not leave the county till I've had an opportunity to thank him in person for his hospitality. Come, Jerry.
Uncle, don't take it personally. Oxmington is known for his bad manners, apparently. It's best just to laugh at him.
So you apparently know more than I do about the way to behave.
Not exactly. I just thought that...
Having thought for myself in every situation throughout my life, I will continue to do so, Jerry, with your permission.
When we entered the inn, my uncle closeted himself with Lismahago, and having explained his grievance, desired that gentleman to go and demand satisfaction from Lord Oxmington in his name. The lieutenant immediately set out on horseback for his lordship's house.
Who are you? I am
Lieutenant Lismahago, and I demand to see Lord Oxmington.
Do you know what time it is?
Aye, too early. By rights, his lordship should still be at dinner.
Who the devil dares disturb my peace?
In the name of Mr. Bramble, I challenge you, Lord Oxmington, to a trial of single combat. It is for you to appoint the time and place.
What?
A challenge to a peer of the realm sent by a commoner and a Welshman? Remove this villain!
No, my sword! You cannot deprive a gentleman of his weapon!
Oh, no? Just you watch me! Another war horse, it makes no difference where he's always had his weapon! Come on, we take him to the trough!
Where is he? Bramble!
My honour has been compromised.
Do you know what time it is?
Yes, sir. Too late. Too late to cower in your bed. Get up at once. I demand reparation.
And I demand that you explain your outrageous behaviour. You're dripping all over my carpet.
Either you compel Lord Oxmington to give me satisfaction or you give it to me yourself.
No. Your second suggestion would be easiest, if you would just allow me to dress myself more appropriately.
Is this how much you care for me that you would take the life of my brother?
Most beautiful lady, I have very great respect for your brother, but I have somewhat more for my own honour, which has been polluted.
Calm yourself, Lieutenant.
Surely, if Lord Oxmington is the polluter, then it is he who should pay.
Exactly my point, sir.
And mine.
Mine too.
Then why don't we discuss how we may take revenge on the petulant peer?
Exactly. Thank you, Jerry. My dear Lieutenant, I hope you agree that we should all now act with a common purpose.
As a result of our deliberations, next day at noon we proceeded in a body to Lord Oxmington's house. All of us, including servants, with our pistols loaded. Thus, primed for action, we paraded before his gate. After dinner, we returned and performed the same cavalcade, which was again repeated the following morning. But we had no need to persist in these manoeuvres, because next morning we were visited by the gentleman who had introduced us to Lord Oxmington.
Bramble, I come to make apologies in the name of his lordship. He had no intention of giving you any offence. Lord Oxmington is a little... ending dinners halfway through the dessert is just one of his eccentricities. As to the humiliations suffered by you, Lieutenant, they were inflicted completely without his knowledge, at the instigation of his valet de chambre, who is also...
If that is the case, I shall be content with Lord Oxmington's personal apology.
No.
And I hope my friend will be satisfied with his lordship's turning that insolent rascal out of his service.
Sir, I must insist upon taking personal vengeance for the injuries that I've sustained.
After some debate, it was arranged that Lord Oxmington should meet with us. He then declared he was sorry for what had happened, and the valet de chambre asked pardon of the lieutenant upon his knees, at which Lismahago, to the astonishment of all present, gave him a violent kick in the face, which laid the fellow flat on his back. So ended a perilous adventure that threatened the nuptials of my aunt and the lieutenant. His lordship went away in some disorder, and, I dare say, will never invite another Welshman to his table ever again. But further perils awaited us at our next port of call.
September the 30th. Dear Doctor, I have been engaged in a ridiculous adventure which I will recount to you when we meet. And I hope this will not be much longer delayed, as I have only one more friend to visit. You have heard me mention Sir Thomas Bulford, whom I knew in Italy. He has now become a country gentleman, but being disabled by the gout, entertains himself indoors by extracting humour from his guests.
Besides our company, there was a fat-headed justice of the peace called Frogmore, and a doctor who seemed to be our host's chief confidant, as well as Bulford's wife, whom he had asked to entertain us on the harpsichord. But no sooner had she begun to perform than Bulford and the justice fell asleep.
Oh, Cara, so, gentlemen, will you talk any more of your pergolosi, your corilli?
At the same time, he put his tongue in his cheek and leered with one eye at the doctor and me. He concluded the pantomime with a loud laugh. Regardless of his gout, he ate very heartily at dinner, nor did he ever refuse a glass when the toast went round. Meanwhile, Justice Frogmore ate the most unconscionable amount, including a large plate of broiled mushrooms.
Those mushrooms you've just consumed, Frogmore, are the kind they call champignons.
Well, very delicious they were too.
Indeed. And to some constitutions, very poisonous.
Well,
Why didn't you tell me that before?
I presumed, since you were eating them so enthusiastically, that you were familiar with them.
No. No. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, as a doctor, I would suggest a glass of herbal plague water. It sometimes works.
So this was brought, and the justice drank it, and retired for the night, not without some signs of terror and discomfort. At midnight, we were all shown to our chambers, and in half an hour, I was fast asleep. But at 3 a.m, I was awakened by a cry.
Fire! Fire!
Not again.
Fire! With memories of Harrogate, I went to the window. Outside, it was dark and stormy, and a number of half-dressed people with lanterns were rushing about in the courtyard. Slipping on my clothes in a twinkling, I ran downstairs.
What happened?
A robber's set fire to the back staircase. Could be worse. There's only one bedroom up there. Look, you can see him now, running around like a squirrel in a cage.
Lismahago? Naked?
Seems they took all his clothes, but dropped them in their hurry. See, over there.
We have to rescue him.
That's all right. I'll find a ladder.
Kim?
Oh, no!
My love! My all-consuming love!
Let's hope it's not his turn to be consumed.
Oh, brother, how can you? A ladder. We need a ladder.
He's still running round.
Matt! Jerry! Somebody do something!
Lord have mercy upon us!
Sir Thomas, do something!
Hardly likely, unless he makes a miraculous recovery from the gout.
Anybody!
Oh, I'm here, madam, at your service.
Oh, happy Clinker. Oh, praise the Lord.
That's right, fellow. Up against the window now.
See, I said I'd find the ladder.
Take good care of the gentleman.
Oh, you can trust me, sir.
Mind your footing, old boy. Quick as you can now. I don't want you burnt to a cinder.
I'm coming.
Oh, Mike, we can see just about everything.
And that from Winnie, who had been in just the same predicament at Harrogate. But I doubt that Clinker was enjoying the view as much as he did then.
Hold it firm now!
I've got it with both hands!
Good, good, good! Keep going and you'll soon be there!
Oh, no, I can't take much more of this.
Nor could I. The sight of the lieutenant in nothing but his quilted nightcap, his lank limbs and posterior illuminated by the torches.
Well done, my good old soldier! Quick, bring him a blanket!
Give it to me!
Oh, thank you.
We'll soon have you warm as chum.
This is just what he was worried about.
Conduct him to the green room. Matt, crown me with oak ivy, laurel or parsley, and acknowledge this as the master stroke of humour. Mm. Oh, for a Rembrandt to do it justice. Did you mark him? All the limbs and the muscles, every toe denoted terror, then the blanket. What a costume!
Yeah, you saying that this was a false alarm?
Aye!
That we've all been frightened out of our beds for the sake of a joke?
And what a joke! What a farce! What a denouement!
Oh, pray God it may not turn out to be a tragedy instead of a farce. The lieutenant has no understanding of humour. He neither laughs himself nor can bear that anyone else should laugh at him.
Well, then he'd better get over it. For such a subject, a Lismahago does not present itself more than once in half a century.
Oh, really? Well, I can see no reason why the lieutenant should be a fitter subject for ridicule than yourself, Sir Thomas. And you will soon find out that you have mistaken your man.
Come, come. He must be a barbarian if he can't enter into the spirit of the thing. Talk to him, Matt. You can bring him round.
It's a disgrace.
So we all went to bed for the second time, and before I got up, my uncle had already spoken with Lismahago in the green room. He must have used the right arguments with him, for the next morning he received Sir Thomas's apology with very good grace.
Good man! Have you perhaps got a pinch of snuff we might take to seal our reconciliation?
If you wish. But this is not my snuff box. There has been some mistake.
Oh, no mistake. I took the liberty of exchanging a gold snuff box for your baser one. All I ask is that I might keep yours as a memento of our good sport.
Sir, you are welcome to it, but I cannot keep this one. It would look as though I compounded a felony in the code of honour. Besides, There may be another joke concealed within its lustre, and I'm not disposed to be forced to perform on your stage again. Please, will you hand me my own bass box, and we will consider the matter at an end.
If you insist.
This exchange was about to throw a pall over the conversation, when my uncle suddenly realised that Mr. Justice Frogmore had not been present either at the night alarm or now.
Has anybody seen Justice Frogmore this morning?
My God, Matt, you're right. I'd forgotten all about him. Doctor, go and get him out of his kennel.
If you promise he doesn't bite.
Now, Lieutenant, you are about to see that you weren't the only actor cast in a role for our entertainment. No. This one has been kept in the wings with a dose of opium until his big entrance. Here they come. Here they come. Frogmore! Whatever is the matter? You look as though you are not long for this world. Help him to the couch, Doctor.
Sir Thomas. Indeed, it is all over with me.
Lord have mercy. What makes you so pale and yellow and bloated?
Those mushrooms I ate at your table, they are the cause.
What? Your stomach? How does it feel?
To this, the justice made no reply, but throwing aside his dressing gown, revealed that his waistcoat would not meet across his belly by a good 5 inches.
Heaven protect us! Never did I see a man so swelled up, except when he was either dying or dead. Doctor, can't you do something?
I'm not certain that the case is absolutely fatal, but I would advise Mr. Frogmore to settle his affairs while I prepare an emetic.
My worldly affairs are all settled. But what will become of my poor soul? Send for the parson at once and put me to bed, for I'm on my way to eternity.
Help him in the name of God.
May God forgive you, Sir Thomas, for allowing such poisonous trash to be served at your table.
His waistcoat, he didn't notice. Last night, the doctor stitched it up tighter. And the disturbance in his bowels, the result of an emetic which he took for plague water.
The vicar arrived at just the moment when the second emetic began to take effect, so he was obliged to hold his nose whilst pouring forth spiritual consolation from his mouth.
Commend the soul of this thy servant, our dear brother.
The same measure was employed by Sir Thomas and me.
Being purged and done away, it may be presented pure and without spot.
The evacuation complete, the doctor ordered Frogmore to be put to bed again. He then examined the excreta and declared that much of the virus had been discharged, and he had good hopes of the patient's recovery. At which the patient, with tears in his eyes, clasped him by the hand.
I shall consider myself forever indebted to the great skill and tenderness of you, my doctor.
And so we left him to sleep. Our host pressed us to stay for dinner, but my uncle insisted we must leave before noon in order to reach our next destination before dark. But before we left, Lady Bulford took us into the garden to show us the new fish pond just outside the parlour, in which Sir Thomas now sat dozing after his morning's achievements. When suddenly Lismer Hargo rushed past him through the room.
A mad dog! A mad dog!
And out of the window into the garden.
What? A mad dog?
And Bulford, forgetting his gout, started up and also leapt, not just out of the window, but right into the middle of the pond.
Lord have mercy upon us. Pray take care of the gentleman. Mind your footing, old boy. Quick, bring blankets. Conduct him to the green room.
The rest of us gazed in silent astonishment while the servants fished their master out and carried him back into the house. Being comforted with dry clothes and a cordial, his senses seemed to have returned when we entered his room.
A pinch of snuff, Sir Thomas. I'm much obliged to you for all your favours, and some I've tried to repay in your own coin.
Give me your hand, Lieutenant. You have indeed repaid me.
Scotland lot.
Oh.
October 4th. Dear Mary Jones, oh, I am quite exhausted with rambling. God send us all safe to Monmouthshire, when you might be surprised to receive a certain new bride's greetings. Mind you, this is just suppository. But let my bed be aired and burn some brushwood in the footman's garret. For Mr. Clinker has got a sad cold by lying in damp shirts at Sir Thomas Balfort's. Always yours, dear girl. Oh, kiss my kitten for me. Wynne Jenkins.
My dear Letty, I am heartily tired of this itinerant life. I'm dizzy with the perpetual succession of places and long for the peace of true friendship that is not to be found amongst fashionable society. Unexperienced as I am in the commerce of life, I've seen enough to give me a disgust to the generality of those who carry it on. Oh, Letty, you would not believe that such malice and treachery could exist amongst professed friends. But I'm too concerned with my own weaknesses to think any further about other people's. I have something on my mind that keeps it in a constant state of terror and suspense. Yesterday morning, as I stood at the window with my brother at the inn where we lodged...
Oh, gracious heaven!
What is it?
It's nothing. Nothing at all. Just a chestnut with a white stocking, like the pony I had as a child.
It's him, isn't it? Wilson. Right. Hey, you! I'd like a word if you don't mind. Hey, wait! Come back here, you scoundrel!
Dear Watkin, you will hardly believe this, but yesterday, who should pass right in front of the inn where we are staying but Wilson on horseback? So, disdaining to accost him, I sent my servant to make inquiries. He returned to tell me that there is another inn at the end of the town called the Red Lion, where a Mr. Wilson had lately arrived. On hearing this, I sent him back immediately with a note addressed to the gentleman, asking him to meet me in half an hour in a certain field with a case of pistols.
Sir, I am glad you have seen fit to keep this appointment.
I didn't feel I could decently decline. So, hats off. Are you ready?
What? No.
Oh.
I beg a parley.
Oh, all right. If only everyone was so easily satisfied.
Who the hell are you?
Jack Wilson. I'm not who you expected, eh? I thought that might be the case. But my name is Wilson, and as your note was addressed to me, I thought I'd better accept the invitation. Well, I did serve in one of His Majesty's regiments, so I have a reputation to uphold.
But I saw him, a man who calls himself Wilson. He was riding towards the inn on a chestnut with a white stocking.
I know no horse nor man of that description.
Please forgive me for troubling you like this.
Oh, no, no. Always good to get some fresh air. Talking of which, I live only 10 miles from here, so if you care to come hunting in the next few weeks, we might even find out who's been using my name.
Thank you. That's most generous, but I am with my uncle and family on our way to Wales.
Oh, any time you're this way.
Dear Watt, I wrote you by last post and did not imagine I should trouble you again so soon. But I need to find some order in the torrent of events that have engulfed us today. We set out this afternoon across country for the post road, but to get onto it, it was necessary to ford a river. Miss Mahargo, myself, and the two servants had just reached the opposite bank on our horses, when we turned to see the mill head give way just as the coach was passing under it.
Quick, they'll be drowned! Come on!
I'm right behind you, sir!
Throat. The end may come sooner than you think. Fair lady, I'm here to rescue you. For that, I need to breathe. For God's sake, let go!
My aunt hung about his neck like a millstone. No bad emblem of matrimony. And, if it had not been for my man, the two lovers would have sunk together into the shades below. For I was too busy rescuing my sister to help.
No, he hasn't! Clinker's got Winnie!
and it's sinking!
What?
Clinker flew like lightning to the coach, that was by this time filled with water, and, diving into it, brought up the poor squire, to all appearance deprived of life.
Master! My good master! Oh, may God forgive me! My good master! My sweet master!
Taking my uncle in his arms, the faithful Clinker carried him ashore as gently and lovingly as if he were a baby. When he laid him on the grass, a great quantity of water poured out of his mouth.
Quick, there's an inn over there. We must get him into the warm. Let me help you.
No, sir. He's my good master, and I'll serve him till the end.
More blankets, landlord.
Yes, madam.
And more salt. I have heard it is most efficacious in such cases. Get all that you have in the house and lay it under his head and body.
At once, sir.
Look upon him with the eyes of mercy. Give him comfort and sure confidence in thee. Defend him from the danger of the enemy and keep him in perpetual peace and safety.
Clinker.
Praise the Lord!
Boy, why are you crying?
Because he that was dead is alive again.
Oh. Uncle, my dear uncle, my best friend, my father, are you really alive or am I just imagining things again?
I hope I'm alive. And that I remain so, dear Liddy. To show you how much your affection means to me.
But the coach was full of water. You were under the water.
Jerry, your clothes are soaked through. I insist you change into something dry and warm.
Forgive me if for once I disobey your wishes, because I must tell you that you owe your life to the great courage and loyalty of Humphrey Clinker.
Clinker? Is this true? Did you indeed fish me up from the depths at your own risk?
Blessed be his holy name that made me the instrument.
Oh. Yeah, Jerry, hand me my purse. Clinker, in here, you will find 30 guineas. Take this ring as well. It is of almost the same value.
God forbid. Your Honour, please excuse me. I'm a poor fellow, but as for the lure of gain, I renounce it. I've done no more than my duty, no more than I would have done for the most worthless of my fellow creatures, no more than I would have done for Lieutenant Lismahago. Oh,
very good of you.
I do believe it, Humphrey. But just as you think it was your duty to save my life, so I think it is mine to express my gratitude. I insist upon you accepting this small token. But don't imagine I think this an adequate reward. For I now ask these gentlemen to bear witness to my intention to settle £30 a year upon you for life.
Good gracious.
Oh, Lord, make me thankful for all these mercies.
You, Humphrey, enough. You embarrass us.
Forgive me, but my heart is very full. And if your worship won't give me leave to speak, I must vent it in my prayers to heaven.
I would have a much higher opinion of his honesty if he did not whine and cant so abominably. But these weeping, praying fellows are all hypocrites underneath.
Mr. Bramble made no reply to this. Instead, he called for the landlord to make arrangements for us to stay at the inn until our carriage was repaired.
I would be honoured for you to stay here, sir. But a gentleman who lives nearby has asked me to offer you accommodation at his house. Mr. Dennison is not only the best farmer in the county, but is a person of great learning and goodness, and his lady is as much beloved as himself.
Even as he continued this encomium, we heard a postchaise draw up.
And he has an only son, a very perfect young gentleman.
And Mr. Dennison himself arrived, and bore us all off to the great comfort of his country house, where, after a good dinner, we men all sat drinking a very fine port, while Clinker made up the fire.
Excuse me, sir. Mr. Dennison, were you by any chance ever at Oxford, Queen's College?
Yes, I was. Why? Now take a good look at me. And think back 40 years. Well, I'll be... Matthew Lloyd of Glamorgan. Jesus College.
Charles Denison, my old friend. I am indeed Matthew Lloyd of Glamorgan.
Oh, idiot! Matthew Lloyd of Glamorgan! Oh, Providence! Matthew Lloyd of Glamorgan! Oh, joy! Your worship must forgive me. Matthew Lloyd of Glamorgan! Oh, Lord, sir, I can't contain myself. I shall lose my senses.
Well, you appear to have lost them already, Clinker. Do be quiet.
Oh, sir, I beg you, wait for a moment.
What's the matter with you?
You're mad vessel.
This snuff box. Please open it.
What is this? How do you... Where is the person named here on this paper?
Here! Here is Matthew Lloyd! As this certificate shows, Humphrey Clinker was the name of the farrier who took me on as an apprentice.
Who gave you these documents?
My poor mother on her deathbed.
And who was your mother?
Dorothy Twyford, and please your honour. She was barmaid at the Angel in Chippenham.
And why did you not show me these before?
My mother told me she'd sent a letter to Glamorganshire at the time of my birth, but had no answer. When she later made inquiries, there was no such person as Matthew Lloyd in the county.
And so, as a result of my changing my name and going abroad at that very time, you and your poor mother were left in want and misery. I'm deeply shocked at my folly. Now stand up, young Matthew Lloyd. You see, gentlemen, how the sins of my youth rise up in judgment against me. Here is my direction, written in my own hand, and a seal that I left at the woman's request. And this is the certificate of the child's baptism, signed by the curate of the parish.
Let me congratulate you, both father and son.
And cousin. Here, give me your hand.
I wish you good fortune, as it is like to be a great chunk out of mine.
But Matthew, why did you change your name?
I took my mother's name of Lloyd as heir to her land in Glamorganshire. But when I came of age, I sold that property in order to clear my paternal estate and resumed my real name. So I am now Matthew Bramble of Brambleton Hall in Monmouthshire.
Well, perhaps this would be a good time to share this news with the ladies.
Brother, you have been very wicked. And I am very sorry to say that the young man whom you have now acknowledged has more grace and faith than you have with all your advantages.
Yes, I admit it, sister.
I think I see on him the same tip of the nose as on my Uncle Lloyd of Lloyd Franklin. Matt, now that you've changed his name, please be quick and change his dress also. That livery does not become any person who has our blood in his veins.
I am proud to own such a virtuous young man as a cousin, whatever he's wearing.
Thank you, Pat.
I wish you joy, Mr. Clinker, or Floyd, or whoever you are. But now... Oh, you'll be so proud you won't want to know us servants anymore.
Indeed, I am overjoyed at my good fortune. But why should I be proud? I was conceived in sin, brought up in the workhouse, and bred in the smithy. Whenever I seem proud, Miss Jenkins, I beg you to remember the condition I was in when you first saw me between Chippenham and Marlborough.
White as alabaster.
So, Watkin. Never say I don't serve you up our adventures like a steak at Dolly's Tavern. Hot and hot, without ceremony, just as they come from the recollection of, yours truly, Jerry Melford.
Dear Lewis, the lord of the manor here is none other than Charles Denison, our fellow rake at Oxford, who has managed to achieve that rural idyll which I've been seeking these 20 years in vain. On the morning after our arrival, I could not help but break out into expressions of delight at the scene.
Those woodlands. The way they're arranged about the house. So stirring with life and yet so peaceful. Mm.
When I took over here, there was not a tree left standing and the fields were wasted with weeds. Oh. The house, too, was in ruins. Yeah. My older brother had died from drink. Shutters were hanging off, jackdaws nesting in the chimneys. Everywhere was dirty, damp, and
desolate. The farmer who kept the keys never dreamed I would live here. Even I began to be unsure. And then I happened to dine at an inn with a Mr. Wilson.
Emil Wilson, did you say?
Yes, do you know him?
Yeah, no. Please go on.
Well, he was extremely knowledgeable about farming and reassured me that the estate was capable of complete regeneration. In 1 week, the house was made weathertight and cleaned from top to bottom, and Wilson himself set to work on the garden. Well, having done this much, I returned to London, sold the house, and brought my wife here for Christmas.
Oh, brave man.
Well, not without some trepidation, I admit. But in fact, she found the reality much less uncomfortable than the picture I'd painted. And then Jack Wilson brought his wife to see us, and she was so welcoming and... Oh, well, a friendship began then that has lasted to this day, even between our two sons.
Well, I hope I shall have the pleasure of meeting your son.
George. Well, he went off yesterday to visit a friend, but hopefully we'll be back for dinner. The truth is, there has been a little difficulty. Well, he's always been the most amiable boy, but, well, we had suggested a marriage for him. A beautiful girl, an heiress to a considerable fortune. But he refused even to discuss it. Just said he was revolted by the idea.
Strong words. Mm.
He was then at Cambridge. But when his mother and I wrote to him pressing for a definite answer, he gave his tutor the slip and disappeared. That was about 8 months ago.
Oh, dear.
Well, he wrote me a letter declaring that he would keep himself concealed until he was assured that his parents had given up the idea of a marriage that must make him miserable for life. And he kept to this till the young lady chose a partner for herself. Then he made his peace with us by the mediation of Charles Wilson.
Wilson?
Yes. As optimistic and helpful as his father. Oh, Matt. Just suppose George has now recovered from his objection to marriage. Your niece, Liddy, is one of the loveliest creatures I ever saw.
Oh, nothing would please me more. But we too have had a little difficulty. Yeah, I'm afraid that Liddy's heart is not wholly disengaged.
Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to present my son, George Dennison. George, Mr. Bramble, his sister, Miss Tabitha, his nephew and niece, Mr. Jerry Melford, and Miss Lydia Melford. George, did you hear me?
Liddy? It can't be.
Mr. Wilson. My sweet Mr. Wilson.
This is my friend, Mr. Bramble.
Oh, yes. Sir. We have met before, I believe.
What?
If you had trusted me with your true identity, we might have avoided a lot of unpleasantness.
Oh. Yes, well... Matthew, what is this?
George, have you really met before?
Yes, Mother, we have. As the son of my old friend, I'm very glad to know you. Am I losing my mind? Do I really see Miss Melford under my father's roof? Am I really allowed to speak to her without giving offence?
Sir... It is a very surprising situation. A providential... I really don't know what to say, but I beg you all to think that what I have said is agreeable.
George Dennison, give me your hand.
Oh, George, darling, I think I begin to understand.
Well, it's more than I do.
Oh, Mother.
My dear children, compose yourselves. You must know that your happiness is more important to us than anything in the world.
Yes. Couldn't agree more, but will somebody please explain?
Which, of course, I was only too glad to do. And things were further enlightened by the arrival of Mr. and Mrs. Wilson and their son, Charles.
Haven't we met somewhere before?
Pistols at tea time, wasn't it?
Of course, the real Mr. Wilson.
For what could be more natural than that George Dennison should borrow his best friend's surname for a disguise, as he followed Lydia on her journey around Britain while hiding from his parents' choice of a bride.
October the 14th. Dear Watt, every day is big with incident and revelation. Young Mr. Dennison proves to be none other than that person whom I've execrated for so long under the name of Wilson. What a relief it is to discover that instead of wasting her affections on some wretched stroller, my sister has in fact captured the heart of a gentleman, equal to her in rank and superior in fortune. George Dennison is without question one of the most accomplished young fellows in England, and already counts me as a friend. Let me tell you, Watkin, the greatest advantage of travel is that you learn to see people as they really are, and not through clouds of prejudice and passion. The day is already fixed for Liddy's marriage, and now Lismahago has begged that one trouble might serve for all, so next Sunday the banns will be published for the four together. And the condition seems to be infectious.
Winifred Jenkins? Clinker? I mean, Lloyd? Don't you think you might do a lot better now?
Well, I feel a tenderness for her and she for me.
Yes, yes, but who knows what plans my uncle has for you? I hope you haven't promised her anything.
Well, I would suffer death rather than do anything that would give offence to the squire. But an understanding does exist between Miss Jenkins and myself, which I do believe should be as binding as any formal engagement.
October 14th. Oh, Mary Jones, Mary Jones. Oh, what choppings and changes, girl. That man who came after Miss Liddy and frightened me with his beard at Bristol is now Matthew Murphy'd into a fine gentleman, and a match between them has been arranged. But this is not the only wedding. Last Sunday in the parish church, the banns were called between old Lash Mahigo and Tabitha Bramble. And there might have been a third. Oh, but what do you think? Mr. Clinker is found to be a pie-blow of our own squire, and he is now out of his livery and into ruffles. You needn't be so proud. I remember you when you didn't even have the wherewithal to cover your posterior.
Miss Jones, believe me, I have the same regard for you as I did then. But understand, I cannot marry without the squire's consent.
Well, ask him. Now.
We must be patient. Trust to Providence.
Why? What objection can the squire make to our coming together? At least I wasn't born on the wrong side of the blanket.
November the 19th. Dear Doctor, so today we have not only the two weddings, but a third. Mr. Clinker Lloyd has confessed to me the sincere love existing between him and Miss Winifred Jenkins, and asked for my consent.
Wilt thou have this woman to thy wife, and love her, and worship her? Wilt thou have this man to be buxom to him, love him, obey him, and all other forsake, to thy life's end?
I will.
I would have wished that he'd kept out of this scrape. But as the maid's happiness is at stake, I have given him leave to play the fool in imitation of his betters. And I suppose in time we shall have a whole litter of his progeny at Brambleton Hall.
With this ring I thee wed, this gold and silver I thee give, and with my body I thee worship, and with all my worldly chattels thee endow.
So I wonder if you could find some employment for him. Tabby says it is no longer fit for her to keep him as a servant. He is hard-working, and could perhaps very quickly qualify as an apothecary. My personal obligations mean that he deserves more than any indulgence that can possibly be shown to him by yours truly, Matt Bramble.
November the 20th. Dear Watkin, the fatal knots are tied, the comedy is near a close, and the curtain is ready to drop. This morning, if one may judge from the looks of the parties, they're all very well satisfied with what is past. George Denison and his wife are too delicate to exhibit any marked signs of their mutual pleasure, but their eyes are sufficiently expressive. Aunt Tabitha, on the other hand, is somewhat too obvious in her display of pleasure with her husband's love.
Oh, woe be dire! Never have I woken so satisfied with the world.
While Lieutenant Lismahago's temper, which had been shrivelled by disappointment, is now swelled out and smooth as a raisin in a plum pudding.
Me and my true love will never meet again.
He kisses her hand, sighs, and sings tender Highland airs.
Of Loch Lomond.
As for Matthew Lloyd, all he can do is throw up his eyes, crying,
"For what we have received, Lord, make us truly thankful."
But what I must also tell you, Watkin, is that Liddy's friend Letitia arrived from Gloucester for the celebrations. And she is a very charming girl indeed. Gay, frank, well-born, of considerable fortune, remarkably handsome, and a little giddy.
November the 20th. Dear Lewis, you cannot imagine what pleasure I have in seeing your handwriting, now it no longer appears in abbreviations of apothecary's Latin. My health is so improved that I hope to see no more of such scribbling. I am determined to defy both the gout and rheumatism, for I am now convinced that we hypochondriacs, far from being sedentary, should increase the motions of the machine and unclog the wheels of life. The plan for our return has undergone some alteration. Jerry has for some reason persuaded his brother-in-law to take his wife back via Bath and Gloucester and will accompany them there. Since nothing would induce me ever to visit Bath again, or London for that matter, my sister, her husband and I will make our own way back to Brambleton Hall, where I hope you will have ready a good turkey for our Christmas dinner. As I have said, I hope I won't have to trouble you any more in your role as a doctor, but I do intend to get to work on you in the pursuit of exercise. I have got an excellent fowling piece from Mr. Lismahago, who is a keen sportsman. We intend to take to the heath in all weathers, and I insist that you join us. And you will have plenty of time to do so, now that you will no longer have to waste it reading the tedious epistles of your friend, Matt Bramble.
In the final part of The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker by Tobias Smollett, Matthew Bramble was played by Nigel Anthony, Tabitha by Marcia Warren, Jerry, Dan Starkey, Lismahago, John Rowe, Lydia, Helen Longworth, Winnie, Joanna Page, and Humphrey Clinker by Stuart McLaughlin. Lord Bulford was played by Trevor Peacock, Oxmington and Mr. Dennison, Sam Dale, Wilson, Nyasha Hetendi, Frogmore, Stephen Critchlow, and the Doctor by Ben Crowe. Other parts were played by Liz Sutherland, Joan Walker, and Chris Pavlo. The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker was dramatised by Yvonne Antrobus. The mandolin was played by Stuart McLaughlin, and the director was Mark Beebe.
And at the same time tomorrow, we have a dramatisation of Hermann Hesse's final novel. Young Joseph Knecht is a rising star of the Castalian Order, a band of elite intellectuals who've lived a closeted life of study and gameplay. But will this prove to be enough for the gifted student?
It's always been like this. Being chosen, followed, listened to, picked out, tested. I've been passed from one teacher to the next, and they all expect me to keep moving higher. And I will, won't I? No one's going to let me settle for anything less.
Part of our Germany season, the Glass Bead Game is a futuristic fable about the struggle to find meaning in human life. In this hour, tomorrow.
Only through time, time is constant.
So restless Cromwell could not cease in
all
the...
All changed. Changed utterly.
BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates National Poetry Day with an exploration of four major historical events that inspired vivid verse.
Anarchy, to thee we bow, be thy name made holy now.
Including the works of Shelley and T.S. Eliot. The Poetry of History, new to BBC Radio 4 Extra, continues weekday afternoons at 1:30 and again in the evening at 8:30.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's a little-known fact that on April the 2nd, 1982, the Isle of Anglesey separated from the mainland of Wales and floated off into the North Atlantic. In our light-hearted drama in 15 minutes, the artist Hugh Hughes will recount the story of this extraordinary geological event. And this evening, marriage will be on the cards for Matthew Paris and his guests in Off the Page.